I remember when I was a younger man. We were soldiers fighting in a foreign land. Now I'm older and it's happening again.
Welcome to another edition of Raising Sand Radio. I'm your host, Susan Gallimore, with Griffin House, and I remember it's happening again to introduce today's show. Darja Mail is author of The Will to Resist, published recently by Haymarket Press, and I'm the author of Long Time Passing, Mothers Speak About War and Terror, published by Pluto Press, also just recently. Darja Mail and I were recently independently invited to present our books in Moscow, Idaho. Today's show airs the main event and includes portion of the question and answer session. This event took place on the University of Idaho campus, where we also presented to students. I have a background in intercultural communication, and I presented to a class on diversity, and both Darja Mail and I presented to different classes on globalization, more specifically on how the U.S. military is used as a tool to force open trade and markets for corporate profiteers. If anyone is in doubt about this, look to Vice President Joe Biden's recent trip to Iraq on behalf of corporate interests to urge Nouri al-Maliki to, and I quote, resist the temptation to demand hefty payments from the international oil companies as the price for doing business with the new Iraq. It's in the interest of every Iraqi to accept a smaller piece of a much bigger pie. So one wonders, indeed I wonder, why the corporate interests Vice President Biden represents are not willing themselves to accept a smaller piece of a much bigger pie. At any rate, let's start off our show today with Darja Mail speaking about his book, The Will to Resist.
I'm going to talk specifically for my 15 minutes about what's happening to the U.S. military as a result of both of these ongoing, seemingly endless occupations of Iraq and Afghanistan. To do that, I want to start by reading verbatim a bit of story of one of the first soldiers I met that really introduced me to the idea of the effect that both these occupations are having on people in the U.S. military, both over in Iraq and Afghanistan, as well as once they come back home. His name is Eli Wright, and he's an Army medic, and he went over and served in Iraq in Ramadi in central Iraq. And at that time, when he first showed up in Iraq, he, along with another Army medic, was called to an enemy detainment camp because a prisoner there needed medical assistance. At the entrance to the detainment facility, Wright was pulled aside by his battalion surgeon and instructed, quote, anything that you see in there, inside those walls, stays in there. You don't talk about any of it after you leave that place. The cell he was taken to was a dark, damp enclosure of bare concrete cinder block walls with a concrete floor and no lights. His memory reconstructs the scene, and his experience is important enough to be quoted at length. He told me, it was the scent of blood that hit me immediately on walking in there. It was a sort of old, stale scent of blood that had just permeated that place for a long time. And they walked us inside, and there was this prisoner in there, completely naked except for a little cloth tied around his waist, and he was standing on top of a cinder block that was placed on end. They said that he had been there for 3 days. His scabbed hands, tied with zip ties that cut into his wrists, were purple and swollen. This guy had the most confused, glazed look on his face. He was being interrogated by several men who were just grilling him. They said he had been up for 3 days in this interrogation process and had not slept. He had been standing on this cinder block for most of the time. They had this bucket of water which they would splash on him whenever he dozed off. They took him off the cinder block and stood him against the wall and told us to start checking him out. And I didn't even know where to begin. He was covered in bruises, his face was all busted up and bleeding. This other medic started to check him out. Our task was more or less to see if the guy was stable, to ascertain if he was in any condition to continue his interrogation. He had some cuts on his face, his nose, his eyebrows, and we started taping those up, not really doing much, just kind of dabbing away blood clots and applying tape over it, not even cleaning his wounds or anything. He was complaining of pain on the side of his chest and his back. He had a lot of bruising on his ribs, so the medic started feeling them and he pressed on a couple of his ribs, and the guy just screamed in pain and sort of buckled. They picked him up and slammed him back against the wall. The other medic told me to feel his ribs so I could feel what it felt like. Said he's got a couple of broken ribs. I verified that his ribs were broken, and the medic started feeling around the rest of the area to feel if there were any more fractures. And then suddenly, he cocked his fist, pulled it back, and punched him right in his broken ribs. And the guy just dropped and screamed. I was stunned. It shocked the hell out of me. It was an important moment for me. Seeing a medic, a fellow care provider, violate our code of ethics, which is first and foremost to do no harm, and to see one of my own doing that to a, I guess he was just a prisoner to them, but to me, I didn't see him that way. To me, he was a confused, broken human being. And to see a medic do that to him, I don't know. I think it just kind of destroyed my perception of us doing anything good for those people. That's when I realized that we weren't there to help anybody. Nothing that we could do would be good. After that point, I didn't feel like there was any further good I could do for those people. That was my first night there. I never talked to anybody else about it. This is actually the first time I've ever spoken about it. That is one reason, a very big reason, why the state of morale in the military, as well as the state of mental health of soldiers serving repeated deployments in both of these occupations, is as low as it is. And I want to, in a very brief way, paint you some broad brushstrokes to give you an idea of the state that the U.S. military is in today as a direct result of both of these ongoing occupations. So far, up to this point in the U.S. military, more than 2 million people in the military have been cycled through both occupations, that in Iraq and that in Afghanistan. Surpassed only by average Iraqis and people in Afghanistan, members of the military who have been deployed to both occupations are paying the highest price, both while there and when they come back home. Now they are part of an unfortunate, tragic segment of U.S. society that has been maligned, tossed aside, neglected, forgotten. Today, more U.S. war veterans are dying, dying by killing themselves here at home than are being killed in open combat while overseas. For example, 1,000 veterans every month who are technically under VA care, receiving VA care, are attempting suicide. 18 veterans a day are killing themselves every single day in this country, from all wars, not just from Iraq and Afghanistan. When you see people on the street in this country, the most conservative figures show us that one out of every four people on the street in this country are a veteran of some war. As if surviving a deployment to Iraq or Afghanistan or repeated deployments is not enough, once soldiers come back home, they get to face yet another battle, and that is to go up against the Veterans Administration in attempts to try to get veterans that are already due them. Supposedly, when you join the military and serve your contract and get a valid discharge from the military, you're entitled to medical care for life from the Veterans Administration. However, in the 6 months leading up to March 31, 2008, nearly 1,500 veterans died while waiting to learn whether their disability claims were going to be approved by the government. Veterans who appeal a VA decision to deny a disability claim must wait an average of nearly 4.5 years to get their answer. As of March of 2008, 287,790 war veterans from both occupations had filed disability claims with the Veterans Administration. Of course, that number is far, far higher today. So, another factor we have to consider when we talk about both these occupations and the difference in the military today as compared to Vietnam is this issue of redeployment. By December of 2006, it was estimated that 50% of the troops in Iraq were serving on at least their second tour, and another 25% were on their third or fourth tour. So where is the military getting these troops? For example, over 43,000 troops listed as medically unfit have been deployed to either Iraq or Afghanistan anyway. In addition to that, we have also 40,000 troops who've already been diagnosed with traumatic brain injury. Traumatic brain injury is what happens when a roadside bomb goes off near your patrol, and maybe you don't get overt physical damage from that, but the shockwave from the blast slaps your brain around inside your skull. And so traumatic brain injury means you come back either completely unresponsive and hooked up to machines. That's one end of the spectrum. More commonly, folks come back and can't complete sentences. Sometimes they forget their name, that kind of thing. So far, we've had over 40,000 troops already diagnosed with TBI deployed to either Iraq or Afghanistan. In addition, we have soldiers already diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder being deployed to both occupations. So, for example, by October of 07, and again, these numbers are far higher today, but by October of 2007, the Army itself reported that approximately 12% of combat troops in Iraq and 17% of combat troops in Afghanistan were coping by taking antidepressants and/or sleeping pills.
You're listening to Raising Sand Radio at KZSU FM 90.1 with Dar Jamil in Moscow, Idaho, talking at the University of Idaho about his book, The Will to Resist.
Another effect that is indicative of the breakdown of the military are suicides. 2007, we saw the highest rate of suicides in the Army since they began keeping that statistic in 1980, only to be surpassed by another record set in 2008. 2008 was also a record year for suicides in the Marines, and this year, 2009, we're also on track to set another grim record of suicides in the Army. Then we have to keep in mind the fact that approximately one-third of all the soldiers serving in both occupations are from the National Guard. So this leads us to the breakdown of the military. Troops coming back home, not getting the care they need, coupled with what they're seeing in most instances, folks that are actually on the front lines in both these occupations, seeing what these occupations are doing to the people of Iraq and Afghanistan, as well as what they're doing to people inside the military. Needless to say, more and more troops are standing up and fighting back and resisting. So to date, we've seen over 55,000 troops in the military go AWOL since the year 2000. And in the last 2 years, we're seeing an increase of, it's averaging between about 7 and 10,000 per year for the last 2 years. And right now, in particular, we're seeing quite a big spike in that number of people going AWOL, particularly due in large part to Obama's first surge of troops into Afghanistan, which we're just about at the tail end of. There'll be 69,000 U.S. troops in Afghanistan by the end of this year. And then, of course, right now, as I'm talking to you, I would presume most people in this room are aware of the fact that they're on the brink of sending another 40,000 troops into Afghanistan. So needless to say, there is resistance, and there are more and more people, aside from going AWOL and things like this, and there's a lot of other types of resistance in the military, but there's a lot of overt resistance of people deciding to become conscientious objectors to all war, not just Iraq or Afghanistan, but also people not even filing for CO status, but that are standing up and saying, look, I'm refusing to deploy to Iraq or Afghanistan. I understand what the U.S. project there is. It's nothing about freedom. It's nothing about national security. It's all about global hegemony. All you have to do is read the National Security Strategy of the United States of America to see that. And so more and more people are starting up and refusing to go. And of course, they're being challenged. They're being court-martialed. They're often, almost always, having to do jail time. But they're doing so with a clear conscience. In my book, I talked at length with a man named Camilo Mejia, who is a staff sergeant in the Army who served a combat tour over in Iraq and then came back and refused to redeploy after he saw what the U.S. government was doing in Iraq. And when he stood up and fought against the military, and he began to take a lot of heat from the mainstream media, of which he was actually getting a lot of attention. And at the time, he wrote an essay called Regaining My Humanity, talking specifically about the fact that he was being called a coward by a lot of people, certainly right-wing press, and even a lot of the mainstream press. And in this essay, he wrote, quote, "I say without any pride that I did my job as a soldier. I commanded an infantry squad in combat, and we never failed to accomplish our mission. But those who called me a coward without knowing it are also right. I was a coward, not for leaving the war, but for having been a part of it in the first place. Refusing and resisting this war was my moral duty, a moral duty that called me to take a principled action. I failed to fulfill my moral duty as a human being, and instead I chose to fulfill my duty as a soldier. All because I was afraid. I was terrified. I did not want to stand up to the government and the army. I was afraid of punishment and humiliation. I went to war because at the moment I was a coward, and for that I apologize to my soldiers for not being the type of leader I should have been." On that note, just to close out and not go over my 15 minutes, I want to mention that after Camilo Mejia's stand, and he served nine months in a military brig, was listed as a prisoner of conscience by Amnesty International, released. We had a man in 2006, the highest ranking member of the U.S. military to date, to publicly refuse a combat deployment to either occupation. And this was Lieutenant Aaron Watada. He was based up at Fort Lewis in Washington State. And in 2006, he took a public stand. The military, of course, court-martialed him. The judge blew the trial. You can't retry someone for the same thing, so because of double jeopardy. So the military ended up basically letting him sit behind the desk for the next couple of years. But then two Fridays ago, Lieutenant Watada, again, the highest ranking person in the military to refuse a deployment, was released by the military, retaining some of his benefits even. And so this sets a precedent where we have the highest ranking person to refuse a deployment that will not serve one day in either occupation nor one day in jail. And the ground today is very ripe and fertile, and there is broad resistance happening inside the military against both occupations, but also against how they're being treated and mistreated by the VA, other things within the military that they're being forced to do that violates international law as well as the U.S. Constitution. So I think that one thing we can rest assured of, that as the Obama administration is on the cusp of being engaged in the most massive escalation to date of the quagmire in Afghanistan, a place referred to by history as the place where empires go to die, we can certainly rest assured that there will be much, much broader resistance within the U.S. military.
That was Dar Jamail talking about his book, The Will to Resist. Both Dar Jamail and I spoke at this event in Moscow, Idaho, October 7th. Now let's turn to my segment of the evening. And my book, again, Longtime Passing Mothers Speak About War and Terror, shares the stories of families and troops in the United States, Iraq, Israel and West Bank, Syria, Afghanistan and Lebanon.
It makes me really proud to see Dar doing this kind of work, because as a military mom, my son has been in the military. He's actually out now. And while he was there, I started learning about the United States military and became a GI rights counselor. And we were dealing with exactly the group of people that Dar has put together in his book. And it's the most heartbreaking thing. It taught me so much that helped me really grow, and also helped me really deal with the reality that so many people in this country are dealing with. So my name is Susan Gallimore, obviously, and my book is Longtime Passing, Mothers Speak About War and Terror. And how I came to this was because, as I say, my son went into the military, and it was a very difficult time because I didn't know anybody else that had children in the military, and it never occurred to me that my son would end up there. And so one night he was in Afghanistan. I was waking up a lot with nightmares. And I thought, I can't go on like this. I need to find other parents. And I need to, reach out to them and understand what they're going through. And at that point, I was like, what am I going to do? How am I going to do it? And it came to me that I needed to have an organization called Mothers Speak if I was going to talk about mothers. And so it's interesting how when you put yourself on a track to do something or to learn something, things begin to open up. And that's indeed what happened. I started meeting other mothers and learning that indeed we knew nothing about what was going on in the United States military. And if we knew nothing about what we were doing here, what do we know about what was going on over there? And what did my son think he was doing in the United States military? Because having come from a background of brothers that had been conscripted in the apartheid military, and grandparents who had left England because of the Second World War, I felt like I had a little bit of an inkling that I had never shared with my kid. And it became very important to me to talk to him and say, don't do anything in this country of Iraq. Don't do anything in this war that you're going to be ashamed of, because no one else is going to be carrying that shame but you. George Bush is not going to be carrying it. In fact, he's not even ashamed that he was a AWOL, essentially, in Vietnam. Bush, Cheney, none of those guys are going to carry this pain for you. So I decided to go to Iraq and talk to him. And I did that, and actually with the help of Dar at the last moment, I got a translator. Things happened, and I ended up not having the driver that I thought I would get. And the two of us, he was Shia, never had been into the Sunni area before, and the two of us together somehow or another found our way to this base in Balad. And I sat down and I talked with my son, and he was kind of puzzled, you know. He didn't say, what are you doing? He just had this kind of look on his face like, what the hell are you doing here? Because just before he came up to meet me, one of the sergeants, my son was a sergeant at this point, one of the sergeants said, oh, so you Sergeant Nick's mom. I know him. We were in Afghanistan together. And then he gets on, and I said, yeah, but don't tell him his mother's here. Tell him Susan is here. He gets on the phone, and he says, hey, Nick, your mom's here. And it didn't occur to me that my son would go through a real difficult time being ragged by the other guys. And that's something we still haven't talked about. While I was in Iraq, I started talking to mothers, and I heard stories that just made my blood curdle. And I realized that I needed to bring some of these stories back to the United States. I was in hospitals where children were dying of cancer. There was a huge escalation of cancer amongst children in Iraq. It has to do with the weaponry that was used. It has to do with toxic chemicals that were used. It has to do with depleted uranium and a lot of other things, including very, very poor infrastructure that has been consistently damaged since the 1990s. When I got back here and started talking about those stories, I also had lived in Israel for a couple of years when I was about your age, some of you, and realized that there was people there that I needed to talk with also. So I went back to Israel, started talking with parents there, Israeli parents, and then I started talking with Palestinian parents. There's a lot of resistance in Israel with the military. It's very frowned upon. You're considered to be a traitor, but there are still people that do it. One of the mothers I talked to, her daughter had died in a suicide bombing, and her two sons were in elite forces in the military. And they came home and they decided, she'd been saying to them, hey, you don't need to be in the military, you know, what are you doing there? And they were just scandalized because everything in Israel is about your position in the military. And after their sister, Smadar, was killed, both Ilik and Guy, her sons, came back and said they're not going to do this anymore. And they've become very strong resistors. Ilik, in fact, spoke at my event in New York, and they belong to a group called Combatants for Peace. And Combatants for Peace works with Palestinian prisoners. And the two of them together talk about the kind of thing that they have been asked to do in their country and they are refusing to do. I also went to Syria and talked with Iraqi refugees. The situation there is very, very dire. People are beginning to sell their daughters into the sex trade so that the rest of the family can survive. It's nothing that we hear about in the news here. I went to Lebanon 6 months after the bombardment in 2006 and talked with people there. And what we have is we have an arc. We have an arc of pain that is happening from a policy that we generate in this country and that we support. And we do it because we make an enormous amount of money with it. And I'm going to read two little pieces. One talks about war and talks about some of this. My chapter in the United States, I also have profiles of some of the mothers that I've worked with and the fathers, but also some of the troops. And I'm going to read one letter from the troop. But before I do that, I want to talk a little bit about war in general. The war to end all wars, World War I, did nothing of the sort. From 1914 to 1918, more than 65 million men mobilized. Up to 10 million men lost their lives on the battlefields, and 20 million more were wounded. The death toll for World War II was over 72 million, including about 12 million related to post-war famines in China, Indonesia, Indochina, and India, and these are often omitted from the casualty compilations because they're people that we don't really care about. They're not really on our radar. More than 25 million of these deaths were military, 40 million civilian, and 5.5 million, as we know, from the Holocaust. Yet in the wars leading up to and including World War II, from 75 to 80% of riflemen did not fire their weapons, even to save their own lives or their buddies' lives. Once the U.S. military recognized this, it immediately improved training techniques to develop a reflexive quick shoot ability that improved firing rates to 90 to 95% by the time the Vietnam War happened. And this is reported by a colonel in the United States Army. His name is Lieutenant Colonel Dave Grossman. He's also a psychologist. And he talks about this in his book, On Killing. And I really recommend that you get this book by Lieutenant Grossman called On Killing. In the military training today, Grossman says, nearly every aspect of killing on the battlefield is rehearsed, visualized, and conditioned, combining manufactured contempt, denial, and contempt for the victim's role in society, as we heard here, desensitization and inhumanity, and practicing on man-shaped silhouettes. In the same period, the military also determined that youth between the ages of 18 and 20 make the best soldiers. They are easy to condition psychologically during this developmental stage when individuals establish stable personality structures and a sense of self. They're also idealistic, and they're vulnerable to the siren song of patriotism. Add signing bonuses that seem like small fortunes, and the perennial glamour of jumping out of helicopters, and voila, our nation has plenty of volunteers. Only in basic training do they learn that they no longer have the same civil rights as other citizens enjoy. David Chu, the Pentagon's Undersecretary for Personnel and Readiness, opined in 2005 that the government was, and this is a quote, was spending too much on benefits for Americans who have served in the military, and that the money would be better spent on bullets and bombs. The amounts have gotten to the point where they are hurtful, Chu said. They are taking away from the national's ability to defend itself. Deputy Assistant Director for National Security Matthew Goldberg testified before the Committee on Veterans Affairs. Depending on the future force levels deployed to OIF, Operation Iraqi Freedom, and Operation Enduring Freedom, if the Congress chooses to fully fund medical care for veterans of those operations, VA medical costs explicitly associated with these operations could total between $7 billion and $9 billion over the 10-year period 2008 through 2017. The costs of disability compensation and survivors' benefits could add another roughly $3 billion to $4 billion over the same period. So when we hear about the numbers that the VA is putting into the vets, remember that there's a hell of a lot of numbers that they're really not counting yet, and those are the numbers that are the numbers that continue to care for the people that have been injured in these wars, but also the wars of Vietnam and the other wars, Panama and so forth, the wars that we don't hear so much about. So the numbers are amazing. The numbers are very telling, and what we're hearing about them is just a small piece of it.
You're listening to Raising Sand Radio at KZSU FM 90.1 with your host, Susan Gallimore. Also, a recording from an event I did with Dodge Mail in Moscow, Idaho, talking about my book, Long Time Passing, Mothers Speak About War and Terror.
So again, there's so much here that I want to say about the stories that I collected in these other countries. I mentioned Nurit, the woman who whose daughter was killed in a suicide bombing. She actually is one of the few people that are well known. I very carefully chose people in my book that are not well known because I believe that it's the ordinary person that's going to change this thinking of ordinary people in the world, not just in the United States. Ordinary people have an enormous amount of power, and it's in a potential stage. We really haven't begun to tap it yet. So along with Nurit was a man called Izzad Ghazawi, a Palestinian father whose son was shot to death by the Israeli Defense Force in his schoolyard. And together these two people worked to bring together a group called Family Circle, and they both received the Sakharov Prize for Freedom of Speech, and I think it was 2004. So they've been able to reach out. They're very well known in Europe. They're very not well known at all in this country. So I really urge you to go and look it up. Internet is a great place, and to find out about what's going on in these other countries, and particularly people that are speaking out. And Family Circle is a good group. Combatants for Peace is a good group. Courage to Refuse is a good group. In this country, Courage to Resist, actually, I was one of the co-founders of that group when my son was being a soldier. I was starting a group to support soldiers that were resisting. So it was an interesting dynamic. I never talked to him about that. I don't think he knows it yet. But I did want to finish with the story of Makisha. Makisha was a National Guardswoman from Oregon, and her mother was from Jordan. It was an Arabic family, and Makisha actually means in Arabic to sweep out. And this was a great, great fun when Makisha actually was in Iraq, because she didn't know what her name meant, and the Iraqi girls that she came into contact with told her. But she went to Iraq after having been promised by her recruiter that she would never be deployed, and that she would be in the United States doing work as she expected to do as a National Guardswoman. 2003, she was in Iraq, and she telephoned her mother one day and she said, I don't know, I can't even tell you what's going on here. She said, I'm Arabic, and here I am on the back of a Humvee shooting other Arabs. She said, I cannot show my face to any of my extended family again. And long story short, what happened to Makisha, she almost died in a helicopter crash. She became lovers with the person that she turned to in the helicopter as they went down together. The helicopter didn't crash. They became lovers briefly through this near-death experience. She got pregnant. They were not interested in continuing their relationship. She was urged. She was in Colorado. She was urged to have an abortion by her commander in George Bush's military, and she refused. And there was a lot of pressure to have this abortion. She refused to do it. She said, I have had enough to do with death, and I want to have something to do with life. So her child was born. She had a very bad injury in her leg, and she still suffers with that. And there's sometimes she goes through a thing of thinking that it might be better to have her leg amputated. She's suffering very much with a post-traumatic stress disorder. Her little boy was born. Part of his brain that deals with language is affected. He's not able to speak. He's apparently the most, I haven't seen him, but he's apparently the most beautiful child, but he's mute. He cannot talk. And I like to read this letter because Makisha has gone through a very rough time. She's now beginning to come out of her shell. She stayed in her house for most of her time, taking care of her kid. She just recently started going to college in Oregon. She's now going to Oregon State. And this is a letter that she wrote to her mother in May 2003, and I put it in this book because I wanted Makisha to know how she felt about things in 2003, because I know that she'll come around eventually and read this letter again. Nights here are a trip in the rainy season. Even the rain is desperate, but I feel at home as if the land holds no hostility toward me. I walked in the desert last night, and there was a pack of wild dogs barking. The moon was hidden by clouds, and as I danced in the rain, my rifle thumped and beat against my calves, and my boonie cap fell back and was held by a string against my throat. The rain fell in great big drops, and the wind whistled across the debris in the sand. Someone was out there shooting the dogs. Those are the ugly moments, interspersed with the beautiful. I heard two shots. I hope the dogs got away. If I didn't distance myself from this world, I'd be more upset than I am. I miss my dogs, my truck, my home, and my people. Yet if someone offered me a ride home tomorrow, I'd turn it down. My crew is here, and the kids need me. I have angry moments, frustration, all the usual things, but I've also found something. I cannot describe the joy I have in living. Even in the bad moments, I find something beautiful around me. I hold on to it with all my power. I may not be able to change the situations I face or the world here, but I hold true to the things that make me who I am. I will change. I will return home a different person, but I'll not let go of the joy in my life. I will not let go of my ability to find beauty in squalor. I can't explain the faith that surges through me, but I know that I will return whole. I will return whole. I will not let this tear me apart. And there were many times when I was writing this book when my heart was so broken, because there I had a kid in a military uniform, and I had all of these stories that I was bringing home to share with people, and I felt like I could really relate to Makisha. I will not let go of my ability to find beauty in squalor. I can't explain the faith that surges through me, but I know that I will return home. I will not let this tear me apart. And I think it's really, really essential that we fight this war and we understand what people are going through, and we really, really also hold out the beauty in the world and the thing that we're really fighting for, which is the beauty of the world and the beauty of the human heart and the beauty of the human soul. And everybody has that, no matter what they tell you out there about how fearful you need to be of people out in another country. You and they all share this fundamental thing, which is the most beautiful thing there is, and that's life. So hold on to that and glorify that, and don't let the other stuff tear you apart.
Now we'll move on to a conversation between Dr. Jamail and myself about aspects of our work. Again, this event was held in Moscow, Idaho, October 7th at the University of Idaho campus. Moderator was Pastor Dean, and he invited us to discuss the difference between what each of us saw in Iraq and what was and still is reported in the U.S. about the situation. That is to say, what is the difference between what's actually happening in Iraq and what we are being told is happening here in the United States?
For me, that's really the thing that drew me over to Iraq, because for those of us who were following the build up to the war, and then especially once the invasion was launched, if you watched mainstream media, it was more like watching a simulated computer model or even a computer game. We didn't really get a taste of what war was like. We certainly didn't know or weren't shown how it was affecting the people on the ground, whether they be Iraqi or whether they be the soldiers in the military that were actually invading the country. So when I was over there and was reporting, the images, a lot of them I would put up on my website, and when I would give full lectures about Iraq and showing, what's it look like inside of Baghdad's main morgue, when they go in and scrape the streets of Fallujah and put piles of body parts and babies' heads and bodies eaten by dogs, and what does that smell like? And then what happens to the families? What are the families of these people? Like, what happens to them? What happens to a woman in Iraq when her husband is killed and then her and the kids become refugees? How are they going to get by? And, this type of information, these types of scenes, and then, like what I talk about with these soldiers, Eli Wright's story, or soldiers coming back home and putting guns in their mouths and blowing their brains out because, they can't get into the VA for another 6 months and they can't sleep. And the army has them all medicated up. I mean, these types of stories. So really there's this huge disparity between what war actually looks, smells, feels, and tastes like, and then how it's like completely sanitized in the corporate media here. We don't have any real idea what war is like. And when you go over there and see it yourself and see literally, you know, what does it feel like to live in a country when there's bombs literally going off across the street from my hotel, and gun battles in the streets at night, you know, of Baghdad, and then going out and seeing bodies, and, you know, like what does that feel like? And, you know, we need a media that's going to show that, because I would argue that if we had media that really, really showed what war is and what it really does to human beings, that people wouldn't be quite so prone to accept war and accept, oh yeah, we need to go invade this country now. So it's, you know, really this huge disparity between the reality and then how deeply sanitized it is in our media.
I've heard you both talk about conversations that you've had with people over there, the people who live there and the people who are experiencing the occupations. Susan, you've talked with mothers over there yourself. Do you want to say some things about the things that we don't necessarily hear on our media here?
Yeah, I do. I also want to follow up to something that Dar just said. I think there's a cohort in this country that could really and is really talking, but they could talk a lot more, and that's the troops. And one of the reasons that they don't talk about it a lot more is that there's no place in this culture to talk about that kind of stuff. You know, you can't really come back and tell your family that you have shot to death an Iraqi family on a Humvee because you were frightened and you had a big gun and you could do it, because your family is not really prepared to hear that. So there's this whole thing going on within the culture that is not really acclimated to hearing these kinds of things and refuses to hear them, so they push them away. One of the very first stories that I heard when I got to Iraq was the very first day, that morning there'd been an attack on a CNN reporting crew, and so I woke up to helicopters flying over our hotel, and the night before there'd been an IED in the road, and this was everyday life for people, and this was in 2004, prior to the attack on Fallujah, which was really kind of the very big beginning of the resistance, the very clear resistance. And I talked to this woman, Anwa Jawad, and she had a little 10-year-old daughter next to her, Abir, and she had a Hassan, about 6 months old, sitting on her lap. And she was speaking in Arabic, and so we had a translator, and her story was she was driving home one night with her husband and four children. The son was 18. He had just been accepted into medical school. There was an 18-year-old, a 14-year-old, a 10-year-old, and then Abir was about eight. And Anwar was pregnant. And they came down their neighborhood. They'd been visiting her parents some other place in Baghdad. They came down into the neighborhood. There'd been an explosion nearby in a transformer. It wasn't a battle. It was a transformer had exploded. The whole energy system there was very fragile. And so two Humvees came down the street. And the guys on the Humvees were very wired up, and they'd already attacked a car on another street nearby, and people there had been burned, and the guys were, you know, geared up. They had a lot of adrenaline, and they had a lot of fear, because they didn't know what this explosion was. And they came down, and they saw Anwar's family car, and they started shooting. And her husband put his arm out, and he said, "Don't shoot. It's only me and my family. You know us. We share cigarettes with you. We share water. You know us." And the guys, of course, couldn't hear, or they didn't care, or whatever, and they just kept shooting. The whole family was killed, except for Abir, this child of eight at the time. And a female soldier, came out from this group, and she kind of pushed the child with her boot, and she figured the child was dead, and she bent down and she picked up the earrings. She took the earrings from the child's ears. And I still think about that woman today. I think, what is she doing with those earrings? She surely can't be wearing them. Maybe she is. I don't know. But that was the first story that I heard. And from there, that was actually the most dramatic, because it was such a shock, because I had a kid, again, in uniform, could have been my kid, and I felt for those kids on the Humvee, because they really didn't know what they were doing there. They had these weapons that just go off, you know, a trigger finger, whatever it is, the weapons go off. They're trained to do that. That's what we're told. I just read that piece out of here. Or I didn't go through any of the war experiences that Dar did. I didn't see the bodies that Dar saw. I didn't see them in any of the countries that I visited. And I think it's important to say that. What I did was I dealt with the civilian groups that were living with this on an everyday basis and listening to those stories. So there's two sides of it. The one is the most horrible that you can imagine, to actually see and smell and taste the death that we're creating. And the other is to actually look in the face of these people and know that you're responsible for the tragedy in their life. That will never really go, it'll never go away. And Anwar would say, you know, what am I going to do now? You know, I have nothing. And I go, she goes to live with her brother. We don't even know where she is now. She may be in Syria, she may be in Egypt, she may be in Baghdad. We have no idea. She's just lost in that crowd. And they offered her $1,000 to pay for the tragedy in her life.
Pastor Dean asked us to comment on our lack of partisanship, that noticing that we pushed neither the Republican, the Democratic, or any other political party position.
People should not be afraid of their governments. Governments should be afraid of their people. You know, when we look at U.S. foreign policy, and I spoke in two classes today, so any of those folks that are here, I went through and specifically quote from the National Security Strategy of the United States, which any of you can Google that, read the whole document. I highly encourage it, along with the Quadrennial Defense Review Report. They're available online. The most recent version you'll find is from 2006, and that is obviously the most updated version we have, updated under the Bush administration. That document specifically, the National Security Strategy, specifically outlines U.S. foreign policy. So if you want to know, why are we in Iraq? Why are we in Afghanistan? This is a document that talks about, highlights the mission, some of the missions of the National Security Strategy are things like opening markets to free trade, integrating global economy, like this kind of thing. It's all about integrating global international markets and bringing other countries into the fold of a system that, of course, will be controlled by the U.S. You can all read it right there. This is not opinion. This is U.S. foreign policy. And this is the same foreign policy that we were operating under George Bush, and it's the same foreign policy, unchanged, operating under the Barack Obama administration. Change you can believe in. I think not. So, you know, again, it's really, I think it's always a waste of time to kind of tee off and, you know, take the pot shots at Bush, which was so easy to do. A little bit more challenging under Obama because he actually has some charisma and is articulate and has a really good speech writer and can speak in complete sentences, which is nice to have a president that can do that. But I think we're remiss if we don't keep our eye on the ball, which what is their specific policy? And he's operating under the exact same policy as that of George W. Bush, as Bush did of Clinton, as Clinton did of the Bush before that, you know, as Bush before that did of Reagan, and we can just keep going. And it is, again, specifically, read the National Security Strategy. It's all about economics, and it's just that simple. It's not about freedom. It's not about democracy. It's not about national security. It's about U.S. hegemony in the world economically and using the U.S. military to make that happen. And that is not a partisan thing. That's not a Republican thing or a Democrat thing.
Thank you, Derek. Susan, would you like to add to that?
Yeah, I want to add now. I mentioned, I think, that I grew up in apartheid South Africa. And only recently has the United States been becoming more interested in Africa. And what they're telling us is they're interested in Africa to make Africa safe and secure for Africans. And this new treaty called the AFRICOM program, the Africans actually are not interested in having that program on any of their sovereign countries. So right now, AFRICOM is based in Stuttgart, Germany, until they figure out which country they can buy off enough to get AFRICOM in.
But what is AFRICOM?
AFRICOM is it's American foreign policy for Africa. Mm-hmm. So very many countries in Africa are buying into this because they can get money, but they're still refusing to have the United States set up bases in their countries because they've seen what happens in Central America. They've seen what happens in the Middle East. And America is there because of the oil. We may already know that Namibia has tremendous oil reserves. Central Africa has tremendous reserves that they're finding. China is in there, and so the United States is trying to get a foot in the door before. So AFRICOM means that we've got United States Navy up and down the west coast of Africa. So it's started under George Bush, and it's been continued under Obama. So those kinds of policies continue, and it's exactly what we're talking about here. It's hegemony, it's owning all of the resources that it's possible to own out there.
The question was asked about, is it possible to oppose the war and support the troops?
I want to start with talking about, I'll try to be brief because this is a very dry approach to this, but someone's obligation when they join the U.S. military, and they swear an oath, which is to support and defend the Constitution of the United States by following lawful orders. There are now, it's very clear, Iraq, anyone with a pulse, I would presume, would understand that Iraq violated international law. One clue, the former Secretary General of the UN, Kofi Annan, on BBC in September 2004 said the U.S. invaded Iraq without UN Security Council ratification. That's kind of a clue. Violated the UN Charter, the Geneva Conventions, of which the U.S. is, of course, a signatory nation. There's only two reasons, according to the UN Charter, that there is ever a just war. One, with UN Security Council ratification. Two, in an act of self-defense. Obviously, neither of those were the case in Iraq, and neither of those are actually the case in Afghanistan, because it wasn't, people say, well, this was self-defense because of 9/11. Actually, it wasn't the nation of Afghanistan that attacked this country, nor was it the people of Afghanistan. It was 19 guys on airliners, 15 of them from Saudi Arabia, and the other four, neither of them, from neither country, Iraq or Afghanistan. So it wasn't an act of self-defense. People like Marjorie Cohn, president of the National Lawyers Guild, will state this very clearly, as will international lawyers and folks like Richard Falk, professor emeritus, and we can go on down a very long list. So point being, both occupations and invasions violate the UN Charter. The U.S. being a signatory country, given the there's something in the U.S. Constitution called the Supremacy Clause. It's Article 6, Paragraph 2. The Supremacy Clause basically states that when the U.S. signs a foreign treaty, then we have to adhere to that. And if we don't adhere to that treaty, we therefore violate our own Constitution. So for a soldier to stand up and refuse a deployment means they are specifically abiding by their oath to support and defend the Constitution by following lawful orders, i.e., they will not, they are duty-bound, they swore an oath never to follow an unlawful order. And the breakdown of that is, if you're in Afghanistan and your commander says, go shoot that little kid, you're supposed to say, because of the oath you swore, as well as just simple morality, no, that's an unlawful order, I'm not going to do it. That is being a real soldier, that is being a real patriot, that is truly supporting the Constitution of the United States. So for these people to stand up and resist, that's exactly what they're doing. And to support the troops but not the war means supporting people like that, but not just those folks, but the people I talk about, a lot of these stories in this book about folks that come back and then have to battle against the VA just to get their foot in the door, just to get their first appointment. They're not getting support from the VA, and these soldiers are here. Some of them are at this university. Some of them are certainly in this community of Moscow, Idaho, and they absolutely would take support if you could find these people, and you can find them by contacting groups like the GI Rights Hotline or Courage to Resist in Oakland, easy to find online, and find these folks and simply go up and ask them, what can I do to help? Because supporting the troops means helping them literally get their VA benefits or helping someone that's going to actually refuse a deployment. There's lots of things that can be done for them. And supporting the troops actually requires action that's going to take a bit more than putting a little yellow ribbon bumper sticker on someone's vehicle.
Thanks, Tara. Susan, would you like
to add? Yeah, I want to actually read something from another resistor. His name is Kevin Benderman. He came from a long line of military people. And he did just that. He said, he looked around and he said, this is not what I believe I'm going to be doing in this military. But he was punished for speaking out against the war in Iraq. During his 2005 court-martial, Benderman was acquitted of desertion, but found guilty of missing troop movements and sentenced to 15 months in jail and a dishonorable discharge. He wrote of that, having watched and observed life from the standpoint of a soldier for 10 years of my life, I always felt there was no higher honor than to serve my country and defend the values that established this country. My family has a history of serving dating back to the American Revolution, and I felt that to continue that tradition was the honorable thing to do. As I went through the process which led to my decision to refuse deployment to Iraq, I was torn between the thoughts of abandoning the soldiers or following my conscience, which tells me war is the ultimate in destruction and the waste of humanity. And I think if Benjamin can go through what he goes through, we can stand behind him and people like him, and that's really supporting the troops. We're supporting people in doing the most honorable thing that they think they can do with their lives. That's our job too.
Let's leave it there. Again, that was Dar Jamail and myself, Susan Gallimore, also a host here of Raising Sand Radio, speaking in Moscow, Idaho, about our books, The Will to Resist and Long Time Passing, Mothers Speak About War and Terror, and also engaging in a conversation-style question and answer session. As usual, all views expressed on Raising Sand Radio are the hosts and guests and not KZSU or Stanford University. Join us again next week. And meanwhile, you can go to our website, Raising Sand Radio, to listen to or download any of our previous shows, all of which are archived. You can find my book, Long Time Passing, Mothers Speak About War and Terror, on that website too. And if you order it there, I'll be happy to autograph it before I send it off. Raising Sand Radio is still looking for a volunteer radio producer. As such, you would work directly with me, contacting our guests, coming up with ideas for shows, and generally taking responsibility for the show with me. For more information about that, please send me an email, susan@raisingsandradio.org. Thanks for listening, and tune in again next week to Raising Sand Radio at KZSU FM 90.1. We'll go out again with Griffin House. I remember it's happening again.
My grandpa fought in World War II, my uncle fought in Nam. My father was too young, he went to school and met my mom. And her dad always told us stories around dinner time. And there's one he told when I was young that sticks out in my mind. He said 10 years after daddy taught me about the birds and bees, I was stranded in Pearl Harbor fighting off the Japanese. When the kamikaze pilots came and dove in without warning, I was on the Arizona on a warm December morning. I remember when I was a younger man, we were soldiers fighting in a foreign land. Now I'm older and it's happening again. It was hard to have forgiveness for the things they did that day, and our president decided we should make their people pay. So we dropped on Nagasaki and we cut him down to size. And the one we dropped on Hiroshima left him vaporized. And I heard some Christians say, what would Jesus do? What if you were on the wrong side? Would he point the gun at you? And they read through every word of Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and John, so they could see if killing was the side that Christ was on. I remember when I was a younger man, we were soldiers fighting in a foreign land. Now I'm older and it's happening again. They separate the church and state and keep God out of schools so our governments can educate based upon their rules. But people start to wonder if our politics make sense when religion is our best excuse for national defense. And when our citizens start saying that our wars are not okay, and Washington keeps telling them God loves the USA, and they teach us history so we can learn from our mistakes, and this generation wants to know how many years it takes to change the way we treat our neighbors all across the land. 'Cause if we don't change our hearts, we repeat the
past again. I remember when I was young.